Check.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Shit Show with J-Bo. In this episode, we interview my old buddy, Colin McCann. The dude's been involved with a lot of music over the years, and we get into all of it. He also builds houses for a living. He's an amazing dude. He's always been a source of inspiration to me. He doesn't like to do interviews, I don't think, but he did one with me. That's very cool. You guys should feel privileged to listen to it, I think, anyway. So sit back, relax, listen to Colin McCann, a.k.a. Lord Dogbird, tell you about his life, tell you about his music, tell you about what he's up to now. This is The Shit Show with J-Bo, and we'll talk soon. Here's my theme song.
Welcome to The Shit Show, baby, welcome.
I think I found an acoustic guitar in my mom's closet. She used to play it when I was a kid. And she hadn't played it for years, but I found it and I just started. I wanted to learn how to play. Dun 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 dun. Dun 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 dun. And
that?
Then just sing the blues, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So I thought I figured that out, but not quite. And then someone sort of showed me a better way to do it, and so that was like what all I wanted to do, you know, was learn that. Dun, 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 dun.
Sounds like George Thorogood, man.
Yeah, well, he he plagiarized it, I think.
Right. And was that in Florida or Maine?
That was in Maine.
Okay, so you grew up in Maine. And
well, New Hampshire too, half and half.
Okay. You came down. Okay, so I met you when you were like 14 or 15, probably, and it was in Florida. Is that how old you were when you came to St. Augustine?
Yeah, I was 14, I think. Yep, just about to turn 15.
And I remember you were going to the movies with my brother, and I was giving you guys a ride.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, hey, man, that guy seems pretty cool. I should get to know that dude. Who's that? That's Colin. All right.
Yeah, I felt the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I had a station wagon, too. That must have been an attractive thing.
Yeah, I love it. I love station wagons.
I think I remember you showing me a bar chord.
No, man. I didn't know anything. You taught me pretty much. I knew a few open chords, I think. Mm-hmm. You showed me how to play Driver 8 by R.E.M.
That's a great riff.
Yeah.
It's one of the first riffs I learned. I think about the first riff I learned was Secret Agent, man. But I also remember trying to cop some weird, really shitty blues riff on a sailboat and not really knowing how to do it.
Uh-huh.
You know. Trying to be, you know. It was terrible, not, you know. Kind of worked, I guess. But anyway, so you, one thing about you, Colin, as I've learned, is you do things, man. You do them quick. You just kind of do them. A lot of people don't. They sit around. You don't sit around, you know, and fucking sit on your laurels or whatever they call it. And pretty quick after me, maybe helping you with the guitar. I don't even know. You were playing. We were both playing. But I remember maybe I'd been playing a little bit longer. You had a notice up in the Fuse Records, and I remember it. And it was like had a picture of a cat, some kind of Felix the Cat or something. Hmm. Is that correct? You're advertising for bandmates?
I don't know if that ever happened.
Well, anyway, I remember you advertising for bandmates, and at the bottom you said, and we're smart too, or something like that. Do you remember that?
No, but I'm not surprised. I think
you're looking for a bass player and a drummer or something.
Man, I think we might have had a band before Fuse opened.
Was there a chance that you'd advertise somewhere else, like the local coffee shop?
Maybe. Okay. You would remember.
I remember thinking that was cool, and before I knew it, you were, like, borrowing my guitar to do a recording with a band called the Don Martin Three. And it seemed to be a hit, and even nowadays on the internet, you can look up those Don Martin Three songs. Like, I was looking at Transistor, and there's people like, one of the 10 best songs of all time, you know?
Yeah.
The shit.
Well, you know.
In fact, that was actually one of the quotes. One Curl was the name of a commenter on YouTube. Top 10 song of all time.
There's a lot of people out there in the world. A lot of opinions.
Now, that song was called Transistor on the Three-Way Split?
Yep.
So Don Martin III, your first band, they put out one unnamed LP, a 7-inch, and a 3-way, and another 7-inch, which is 3-ways.
Yep.
Describe that band, man, and how you came to that sound. What were what bands were you listening to?
Well, Don Martin III, I don't know. All I can remember about that is just feeling this, like, insatiable urge to do something. And it seemed like it just seemed obvious and that it had to be done. And there wasn't, like, a lot of thought about it. It was just kind of what's going to happen here. And that's just sort of what coalesced around that feeling, I guess. We lived in a small town, and there wasn't, I guess what we were starting to do is maybe influenced a lot by a record store that was in that town that sort of introduced an element of music that I guess you would call punk. It was a manifestation, I think, of what is the punk ideal or ethic. And at the time, it was, I guess, the early 90s. And 7-inches, I guess, just from sort of the genre that at that point was called hardcore. And under that genre, there was many different aesthetic things. And you didn't necessarily have to fit a sound too precisely, but yeah, just a lot of 7-inch records and a couple of zines that sort of like seemed to push it all forward.
Where were those coming out of, those zines?
Mostly California. The big one at the time for us was Heart Attack, which was, there was a label called Ebullition that some people may recall. And I think that was like in, outside of Santa Barbara, California. And yeah, the scene called Heart Attack, and they reviewed pretty much all of the hardcore records that came out at that time. And no matter what, you just had to send them your record, and they would review it. And their one stipulation was it couldn't have a barcode on it. Mm. So, and the record store Fuse was sort of like the epicenter for that, and it just introduced that to a handful of kids that had no other exposure to that sort of a thing. And there was probably a handful of records at that time that were sort of, when that band came together, that were kind of influencing what we were doing. But yeah, so we just kind of set about to just do what we felt like we needed to do, and it kind of just, it came really easy, and I don't even know, there wasn't really a set path to follow, it didn't seem, so we kind of forged one a little bit, and then through doing that, some channels opened up that were sort of kindred spirit, I guess you would say.
What were some of those bands?
Some of the bands on those...
That would fit the mold of kindred spirit for... for Don Martin 3.
Oh, well, there was a scene that was kind of happening at the exact same time, a few around Florida where we lived, especially in Gainesville. Also some bands from Tampa and Daytona. And so that's where we sort of eventually somehow those scenes or those people doing those bands and having house shows and whatever, like all of that, somehow we all found each other in a way. And I don't know, maybe some element of that is still alive. I'm not sure if it is or not, but so yeah, there were some bands around there that we played with a lot. Hope Springs Eternal was from Daytona, Moonrakers from Gainesville, Palatka from Gainesville. Those were kind of our closest pals, played a lot of shows with and stuff back then.
Right on. And how long was the Don Martin 3 active?
I'm not sure, really. Time is weird and gelatinous, especially if you go that far into the past, you can kind of look at stuff. I think it was like 3 years, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
Something okay. in that range. It seemed like a fair enough, a long enough time. But I remember at one point it didn't seem like there was anything going wrong or anything like that. But at one point, we just all kind of decided, like, yeah, let's play one more time. And we did that, and that was it.
Where was the last show?
It was in Gainesville, Florida, at a place called the Utility House.
Now, Don Martin 3 was a three-piece. And who were the members, aside from yourself?
My friends Brian and Dave.
Okay, so the Don Martin 3 ceases to exist. Obviously goes on. There are 7 inches out there that people are still collecting. And where does it go from there? I know you got in another band, but you didn't sing in that band, which might be slightly odd. Were you attempting not to sing? Did you want to sing?
No. No.
I figured you'd want to sing after the Don Martin 3, but no.
No, man. My really dear friend and I kind of talked about playing music together, and he is and was a brilliant writer, I thought. And just someone who there's a soul connection that is beyond space and time, or maybe this particular experience that we're having here. And it was just clear that was, he had the things to say that I felt were encapsulated in how we felt or how the music sounded, I guess.
Oh,
There was a long period after that band that there wasn't a lot of ambition to make another band.
Yeah.
So just kind of traveled a lot and played the acoustic guitar and like played on the street and sort of tried my hand at that a little bit, just traveling and with an acoustic guitar and whatever happened there. And I traveled with my friend James, and we would play.
Where were you guys traveling to?
Oh, just around the United States, kind of with a goal to make it to the West Coast. Yeah, so we traveled for about 6 months and lived in a van and just met people and just experiencing stuff in youth like everyone does. So that was sort of like a good impetus maybe for a new thing to open up.
Now, James was the owner of Fuse Records, correct?
Yeah. James and another fella, Brett, started Fuse. And, yep.
And
that's where I met James.
Around that time, I believe, I'm really not attempting to inject myself in the story too much, but I think I was being a DJ at WFCF Flagler College Radio, or around the time. But you had picked up this new interest, this band that I remember called Lungfish. And I never really got them. And I would play them on my show occasionally because I knew you would like them. And I knew they would kind of go on to influence a bit, I felt anyway, like your trajectory of where you would go next with James. Can you tell me a little bit about how that influence entered your life? And how that affected you?
Yeah, a friend of mine recommended a record by that band. And back in those days, lyrics were pretty important, and we would always read the lyric sheet, you know, when we were listening to a record. And, so I got a chance to get a hold of this record, and I listened to it. And it was sort of, it definitely felt like a timeless experience the first time I heard that band. And it's hard to describe. It's hard to really describe. It definitely wasn't this whole thing with music or bands. It's a fine aspect to what we're experiencing, but it's a pretty limited scope where I think what it's trying to speak to, what it's trying to praise, is a larger, you know, this experience that maybe doesn't have words. And that's something that that band Lungfish did, I think, was sort of transcendent would definitely be a word that comes to my mind. Kind of, it's just beyond time and genre and whatever else. Just a pretty heavily ancient thing that went on with those people in that group. And deeply spiritual music. I think people that know the band and have enjoyed them over the years, that there's a common thread there with people who appreciate that, I think. And it's usually one where it's just sort of a it's hard to put into words. I don't know if it's really my place to do it, but yeah, they were a great one. They still are. I think that will stand the test of time.
Now, your love of this band, the next band you would form, the next major project, The Wilderness, they are known as a Baltimore band. Wait, sorry. Yeah, that's right. Baltimore band. And would you loving that band Lungfish and Dan Higgs and all that, would that lead you to Baltimore? Is that how you, I mean, is that one of the reasons why you went up there to start a band? Or was James from there? Or how'd you go there?
We met Daniel on that trip to going out west, actually.
That's Daniel Higgs, lead singer of Lungfish.
And he recommended we check it out at one point. So I think you guys would like it.
Where did you meet him?
In Austin, Texas. And how we came to move to Baltimore is Brian and I moved to D.C. We lived in D.C. for about a year. And at that point, we were trying to put another band together, and we knew that James was going to be the singer. And James was in San Francisco for quite a while, and then decided, okay, he's going to come back, and we're going to try to have something come together in D.C. And by the time he made it to D.C., our living situation was kind of tenuous and difficult. And a couple of our roommates decided they wanted to move to Baltimore. And when James was there, he decided, yeah, I think I'm going to head up there too. Nothing really seemed to be opening up in D.C. So the three of them moved to Baltimore and got an apartment. They got a beautiful apartment for like a big two-bedroom apartment for like $400 or something like that. And so I remember going up to visit James, have dinner and spend the night or whatever a few times, and just being like, wow, this is a whole other world from D.C. Like, you can breathe here. This is a place that feels real. Not that D.C. isn't. I think just at that time, for whatever reason, just your limited scope of a place, It just felt a little oppressive to me at the time. And then going to Baltimore, it seemed obvious that this was a better place to live, a cheaper place to live, just more down to earth. And there's always been music and art happening there for that reason. And there still is to this day. And that's why we decided to move there ultimately. Long story short, Brian and I we didn't have any money, shit was fucked up. We went back to Florida for a few months, mm-hmm. got jobs, mm-hmm. wrote a bunch of songs.
Mm-hmm. Instrumentations.
Yep. Yeah. We were playing with our friend Joe, was playing the drums. Mm-hmm. And we went up to Baltimore for a little trip to visit James and try this jam.
Yeah.
And we did it, and it was instant. We started playing in a friend's practice space. James started singing, and I felt like I was levitating. It was like a complete fruition at that moment, and it was unanimous. And so we said, okay, we'll be back. We're going to get our shit together, and we're moving to Baltimore. So in that time frame, our friend Joe, who was playing the drums, said, I can't go to college. He was going to Flagler College. Mm-hmm. He said, I can't move to Baltimore, man. It's just not my path. So James was hanging out with this other dude, Tim, that we knew a little bit from San Francisco. He moved there with our friend Willie, who took to Baltimore from San Francisco. Willie was in the band, the aforementioned band, Hope Springs Eternal, our friends from Daytona from high school. So they moved to Baltimore around the same time James did, or a little after he did. And this guy, James said, this guy Tim wants to play drums. Come on up, he's going to play drums. So that's what we did. And we just started practicing pretty much right away.
How long did it take you to get your first record out?
Oh, from there, what was that? It was probably 1998 or 1997. So it took, the first record came out. I mean, that band kind of just, Tim left that incarnation of the group. Willie actually played keyboards with us on a couple of performances. it fell apart for a while, and then Willie said, I'll play drums. So the first recording or record that we released, I think that was 2004, so whatever math is there, 7 or 8 years.
Wow. Did you guys do a fair amount of touring between there?
No, we didn't. We played around Baltimore pretty much exclusively, a little bit in D.C. We played in New York, Boston. That was about it, though. We never really toured until right before we put out our first record.
That's a pretty serious gestation period. Did you feel like it was going well? I mean, before the first record came out, did you feel like people were digging it and people were coming back to the shows?
No one came to the shows. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, a few people came. Our friends came.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
It wasn't about that. We just felt like we had to do it. And that's how it always felt. Yeah, then we put out a record, and there was, you know, the sort of random opinion machine just sort of spit out the ticker, and it happened to be the right opinions at the right time.
Right.
So the people that follow the opinions took heed, and then people said, oh. But nothing changed for us, or at least we really tried, and maybe we tried too hard, but we tried to just stay true to whatever was always the purpose for us.
Now, that first record was it just self-titled?
Yep.
Yeah. And it was released on Jag Jaguar?
Yep.
How did you get hooked up with that label? Tell me about the night maybe that they decided to sign you.
Well, we just sent them, kind of cold called them, sent them a record. And the only reason we did that, I think we only sent the record to like 3 people. Three labels, and they were one of them. And the reason we sent a record to them is our friends from the band Love Life put out a record or two on that label. And they said that they were cool, and they had integrity, and seemed like a decent kind of eclectic aesthetic at the time. So we sent them a record, and they got in touch, surprisingly. They liked that. It was wild. And they said, we'd like to see you play live. We'd like to put out a record, but we'd like to see you play live first. So they booked us a show in Bloomington, Indiana. And that's a long way from Baltimore. So we tried to set up a show on the way there, but of course we didn't have a record, and difficult to book shows. I think we ended up getting a show. We thought we had a show in Columbus, Ohio, and we got there, and it was like a battle of the bands open mic kind of a thing. And got there, and this band was playing, I think they were doing Bomb Track by Rage Against the Machine. And they started it, and it sounded pretty true to form, true to the record. And then they stopped and said, wait, bring that back. And then they did it again. They kind of started it 3 or 4 times before they did it. I don't really remember the whole thing too well, but it was definitely a little like, whoa. And then the next night we played in Bloomington, and we gave it our all, you know. We wanted to put out our record. We had already made it. And I guess it went well. They liked it enough, and they said, let's do it. We had dinner, and pretty informal, you know, no big deal.
Were you guys completely stoked?
Totally stoked.
I would have been stoked.
Yeah, we were totally stoked, man. It just seemed right. It seemed fine, and it was.
Now, The Wilderness went on to release 2 more full lengths, one the next being Vessel States, and then Nowhere. Do you feel like Vessel States, upon its release, was bigger than your first one, or was it about the same as far as reception, as far as people you were playing to? I know you guys did some pretty substantial tours and played some people. How did the trajectory work from album to album?
Oh, it seemed like a steady, very like sort of steady. Hit the peak, and then it was just kind of coast downhill from there. It seemed like all one thing at that point. We were just writing songs all the time, and I think we might have been at our best if I remember. I remember our touring and everything. I think when Vessel we toured for that record, I think we were at our best. We toured a lot for maybe 6 weeks in the States and like a month in Europe. And by then we were just like improvising between songs without ever talking about it. Between shows, things like entire like parts of songs were just sort of occurring, and then we'd repeat them somehow. All of this was sort of unspoken. We would never have breaks between songs. They would just sort of flow, and I remember it just being really limber and really open and free, and feeling like the music was able to, I don't know, that the spirit was able to be contained in the music without too much baloney. And it was nice because people were coming to the shows and made enough to make it worthwhile, and we didn't have to spend a ton of our own money on gas, and so you kind of live in the dream at that point. So yeah, it was great.
I believe I saw you on that tour. I could be wrong. In Seattle with the Crocodile. Does that sound about right?
I believe you on that.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Vessel States was followed by Nowhere LP, written, I don't know, explain to me again, I'm not exactly clear, I can't really describe it, how that came about, the third record.
We were pretty much on a hiatus, and it seemed like maybe we wouldn't play anymore. Brian was living out west, and the band was pretty much just not happening at the time. And we kept getting these emails from this guy, Charles Long, who is a conceptual artist that we hadn't heard of, but he kept saying that he wanted to do a collaboration, and I think we pretty much just never responded to the emails. And then another one came, and it was like, yes, I'm doing the Whitney Biennial this year, and I really want to do this collaboration with you guys. Would you be open to it? And sort of serendipitously, James, who was James and Will both were art handlers, and they installed some piece in New York by this guy Charles Long like that, somewhere right around the time frame where we got this email, and James just said, well, yeah. This guy, it was pretty, really cool piece. Just came together where that name clicked in his mind. Like, that's the guy who was emailing us. So we wrote back and said, yeah, we might be interested in that. And he flew to Baltimore just for an evening and stayed with us. And we had dinner, and he and James and I just talked about his ideas for it. And he said, just do what you want. I'd like it to be about 40, 45 minutes long and compose a piece of music. And it's going to go with a lot of like video and performance stuff. And we'll perform it at the Armory building up in New York City at the Whitney Biennial. So we thought it was a cool opportunity. And we decided that we'd like to do it. And we contacted Brian, and he said, yeah, I'll come back to Baltimore and let's work on this. So that's what happened. We did it. And that was a record that was written really in about a month or two of just playing every single day. I had a bunch of guitar stuff sort of compiled at that point just from playing around the house. I went and jammed with Willie and we sort of taped it, and it was plenty of material at that point just from the jam, and we kind of formed it out of that one jam. And then other things came out of that when we all got together and we decided that if we're going to do it, we might as well record it, make a record out of it, and do a tour. And had a feeling that maybe it might be our last opportunity to do that. And up until this point, it's proven to be true. So that's what we did. We recorded it and had a lot of fun making the record. We performed it in New York, which was a really wonderful experience. And then, and then toured on the record one last time. And that's what that was, basically.
What were you trying to do with your guitar playing during the wilderness?
I just playing whatever I thought was beautiful sounds to me. Whatever sort of, when it was flowing free in an honest way that I felt was a place where the mind could be clear and free. And you get to that point that where we all play music, you know, we kind of hope to sort of forget what our name is or forget where we're actually standing and just sort of sit there and in the moment. And that's what all I was trying to do with it, really. And just make it sound beautiful. That it's something that appealed to me and that hopefully appealed to my friends that I was playing with as well.
Now, there's another project of yours who's put out two records. You put out two records under the name Lord Dogbird. And how do you make this transition? Because I'd seen you and you and your wife, and you told me, or you guys told me that a solo record in essence had come out under the name Lord Dogbird. How do you go from wilderness into this?
That was when Brian moved out west and the band stopped playing at that for about a year or more. This is before we made that last record. Mm-hmm. I just decided I wanted to make some recordings, and I bought a 4-track. And I started messing with it, and I just was like totally into it, man, like really, really into the sound of the 4-track. And I was just basically started messing around, and then the songs really maybe seemed like they started to come and have a shape of one thing, and then it just became a record. I realized, like, oh, I guess I'm making a record here. It was probably over about, I don't know, 6 months or a year's time where I did that, just working on the 4-track at home on my days off from work. It's like all I did.
Now, this is when you were living in Northern California?
Nope, I lived in Baltimore.
Oh, when that started, okay. And also, Jag Jaguar put out that record, correct?
Mm-hmm.
The instrumentation for Lord Dogbird to me is pretty interesting. You're using, I believe, a pump organ. Aren't you on some of it?
Not on that record.
Okay. Is that what instruments are you using on that first record?
Guitar. There's some mandolin and there's ukulele on there. Wurlitzer piano, some like kind of hand drums or like beating on furniture and stuff, just with a bunch of crap on it, distortion and delay or whatever. I think that's about it.
Did it appeal to you to have like total control over your musical project after being in a band for so long?
Yeah, man, it was pretty nice in that way, for sure. Not that it was ever a drag in the band, but I enjoy collaboration. I always have. But there was sort of an element of just, like, you can eliminate that sort of go between and just go straight into it, and there doesn't have to be any double checking if it's cool or whatever. You just know it's what it's supposed to be.
Now, at what point in relation to this recording did you move out west?
Well, sort of, we're going kind of hopscotch, but yeah, so then after I did that solo thing, then we did the collaboration with Charles Long.
Oh, okay.
And then...
So it was before that.
And then moved out west. After that collaboration, moved out west almost relatively soon after that, I guess.
And what was the idea of moving out west?
Oh, it's kind of just a long-standing dream, I guess, for lack of a better word, to live in the woods since I was a kid. So it's pretty much what I've envisioned. And we came out here to sort of see if that could happen.
I remember things like being, you know, 16 or 17 or 18 or whatever, and you coming by and grabbing a tent or a sleeping bag, some kind of camping thing, because you were going to go out to some national park for a few days. And I remember thinking, wow, man, that's hardcore. That dude's like a really young guy, and like, he's going out to the forest for a couple of days, you know.
Yeah, Ocala National Forest, man. That's what I think where I was going in those days, the Florida Trail. That place was pretty awesome.
You came out here, you got some land, and ended up becoming some kind of, you know, carpenter, and it's phenomenal. Like, I don't know, I'm totally blown away by what you're able to do out here, honestly. Like, it's insane, like, in a cool way. How does that happen, dude? Not a lot of people do that or can do that.
I don't know, most of that stuff seems kind of ingrained somehow or sort of predetermined.
Because I never knew you'd be a builder or anything. I mean, you cooked.
Yeah.
How'd you learn to build, man?
Just out of necessity, really. I had a couple of friends who were really good at it that I helped.
Okay.
Kind of towards the tail end of living in Baltimore, I had a friend who was a really good carpenter that I was sort of his assistant or whatever, his helper. So I learned a lot from him, and then I had another good friend who did the same. And my wife is also really good with her hands, so learned a lot from her. Just learn from people, you know, and then really the only way to really learn is, you know, by necessity, having to do something. And that's basically where we started, was with a little bit of knowledge and experience, we had to build a house, like a little cabin to live in. And we had 6 months to do it or whatever before the winter came, so... you know, in that kind of situation, I think most people just do what they got to do. But
most people,
that's what we did.
That I know. In fact, you're the only person that's ever done that I've known. I'm sure it's happened.
Oh, it's certainly not. Yeah, it's not a rare thing, I don't think.
Well, it's rare where I come from. I don't know. I don't know how you get that kind of drive and
it's where you come from, it's not really a necessary thing because there's housing, you know. We ended up on a kind of a...
Yeah. I mean, you threw yourself into a situation where you would have to do this.
Yeah, I guess you could perceive it that way. Yeah, sure.
In the rain.
Trinity 9, the second record for Lord Dogbird. I noticed, I was looking at the artwork, and I think it's on the front or the back, it's one or the other, but there's some chemtrails. It's like an X. Oh, sorry, I don't know. They look like, you know, jet stream exhaust forming an X in the sky.
Uh-huh.
Did you take that picture?
Well, that's under some some dispute. I thought I did, but Beth is quite sure that she did. So I think she did, probably. I think ultimately she took the photo. But I remember going out on the deck, and I remember the moment well. But I think she had the camera.
Now, you had never heard of Alex Jones, to my knowledge, or knew anything much about him before I got here. But you had seen InfoWars bumper stickers, which were fairly interesting to me. Alex Jones is known as a conspiracy theorist.
But, yeah, that's a dime a dozen out here.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That type of thing.
It's just a way... things that are commonly discussed, I think, in the population centers are just almost don't even enter into the conversation out here. It's a whole... kind of a whole other bag.
So chemtrails will come up from time to time
in all conversation? All the time, yeah.
Do you have an opinion on chemtrails?
You hear that. I don't know if an opinion does any good ever, but in regard to that, my opinion is that it's some sort of display of perfection.
Display of perfection?
Yeah. I guess that would be my rough opinion on that.
How so? Can you care to elaborate about that?
Well, just that all things are that, but there was a time I was a little bit worked up about that. And, I just would take note of it. And when you live in a place where the sky is sort of on display all the time, there's not a lot of other things capturing your attention, I think you become a little bit more aware of it. And it seemed like a pretty obvious campaign that was going on. And you know, there's not much factual stuff you can find out about that, if there is such a thing as factual information out there, you know, outside. But I don't know, man. Yeah, I guess I'd have to say I don't really have an opinion on it. I don't doubt or reject that it's real. I also don't accept it. I don't believe it either.
I guess I'm right there. I'd like to believe it. I think it's an interesting theory.
I think it's obvious that nothing is as it seems, and if you view something, all you can do is view something with your own eyes. You can observe it and try to cut out the extraneous noise surrounding it and see what's left. And yeah, there's something going on there, but like I said, as it should be.
What does the term hard work do for you, man? I feel like you're one of the hardest working people I've seen, I've been around. What's your relation to that?
I've definitely felt that way about people, too. I think you can go further and further. I don't know, man. I don't know what that's all about. I think diligence is a virtue, but I also think there's sort of like the other side of it where you go too far with it and it becomes a distraction. And I think maybe that can be that's a danger, you know, that you can fall into with this thing called work. I think there's one real work that we're all up to, or that we all need to be doing. And I think that a lot of the stuff that we call work or whatever, I think detracts from that. So I don't know, that's sort of a balance that I'm always trying to strike.
So you find, like, you can easily fall into, like, too much work, too much, like, where you're distracting from all other aspects of your life? Is that an issue for you?
It has been in the past, I think. I think I've really sort of tried to hone in on a different sort of focus in the past couple of years that I think could continue to improve even, but I know it can never really stop improving, but yeah, for sure. It's one of those things. I think there's, you know, there's, you have to find a balance always, and wherever there is that sort of tendency for overdoing something, you gotta be careful.
Like the other day we did some garden work, and at some point there was a piece of board, and you were trying to improvise a way to hold the dirt from spilling out of the old flower bed, and you had an axe on you, and you're just like, maybe this will work. And before you even really thought about it or thought about whether it worked, you know, you start bashing this thing, and it kind of worked, and it was like, it was so quick, you know, it was just, it was like so quickly into action, you know. I would have had to think about it for 5 minutes and probably not even done it.
You know? Yeah, I don't know, man.
Yeah. So your most recent musical project I found interesting, called Reggae 90210.
Yeah.
And I believe they put out, you guys put out, it's you, your wife, and a gentleman down the street named Fran.
Mm-hmm.
Quite unorthodox. I was under the impression that it was a reggae group.
Yeah, you weren't the only one, yeah.
It didn't strike me as odd because I know, like, you would turn me on to some Black Uhuru back in the day. So I was like, well, hey, maybe, you know, he's been playing reggae or something, you know. It didn't strike me as that odd. But I'm sitting there watching, and, like, all of a sudden there's a bunch of noise happening. And you're not even on guitar. I was like, what the hell's going on here? And then you start, and it was just this thunderous, like, dum-dum-dum, you know, just really percussive, really in your face, really loud, like three-piece instrumental music, nowhere close to reggae. And I just laughed my ass off, man.
Good.
I literally was like, the whole time I was expecting some kind of reggae. I did notice that your drummer didn't even have a hi-hat, and I was like, I think that's pretty crucial to reggae. Tell me about that project, man, how that got off the ground.
Oh, man, yeah. That was basically, Beth just started playing the guitar around the house. She's like, can I play that electric guitar sitting over there? I said, of course. And
because you usually don't let people touch your guitar.
Yeah.
Right.
She had an affinity for it, man. It was incredible immediately. And she sort of took her relative mastery of the physical plane and brought that to the electric guitar. And yeah, we went on a little trip to the coast with our friend Fran and another friend of ours who was kind of an early member of that group too. And
there were four at one point?
There was, just for a brief while. And we just talked, we should play some music. I said, yeah, Beth's been playing the guitar, let's do it. I said, I think I want to play bass. So I went and I bought a cheap bass for $150 and we got a couple of cheap amps. Fran bought some drums and we just started jamming, and it was, just had the tape rolling, and it was a lot of fun.
It was kind of a interesting story, well, at least interesting atmosphere when you actually recorded.
Yeah.
For the cassette that was released, right?
Yeah, we recorded with Fran's friend, whose name is King Hopeton, and he's a Jamaican national who has a studio over in the mountains outside of Chico. And
Chico's a party town.
Yeah, it's like a college town down there, yeah. So we went and went to make a record with this guy, King Hopeton. in his studio. It was crazy. And when it was all said and done and the smoke cleared, so to speak, we were stoked with how it came out.
Yeah.
It just sounded live and raw and exactly how we like it. So
yeah,
it was done. And there was no fussing. We didn't really mix it per se.
Yeah.
He just did it all in a cloud of brilliance. And it sort of was like for us, maybe a little bit of confusion during the process. We did it. It was all one take.
Your hands in King Hopeton.
We just did it live, one take.
Sorry, put the music in the hands of King Hopeton, really.
No overdubs.
Yeah?
The whole record. And
I noticed it mirrored your live performances, if I'm not mistaken,
that's
right?
All it was, is we just played. Yeah.
Because I saw you guys a couple times, and then the next day I had this radio show in Seattle, and I played the whole thing, and I realized, oh, wow, the live set was like pretty much this. That's an interesting way of doing things. It's kind of cool.
It's really enjoyable. You just can really hone it. Yeah.
What's it like playing with your wife?
Oh, it's wonderful. It's a lot of fun.
She played great. She plays great. I thought it was
awesome. Better than I ever could.
Mm-hmm. And the drum stylings, once again, awesome. I mean, he plays with a kit. It's like she said, double everything. Double bass.
Yeah, he's into symmetry. Physical symmetry.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Just keeps his head down and does it. Hell yeah. Well, I think that brings us up pretty close to the present, man. I want to thank you for doing this.
You're welcome.
And, yeah, man. Safe carpentry. Safe travels for myself.
Indeed.
And any parting words, man? You're on the shit show with J-Bo. Any parting words?
I'll just say farewell.
All right. All right, see you, man.
Later.